Good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad to be here with you for a couple minutes and looking forward to sharing some of the things that we're doing related to innovation in the federal government, and also hoping to hear from you, get your feedback and thoughts on some of the stuff I'll talk to you about, and see how you can shape our work. I sort of wish we were like in Starbucks somewhere, you know, sitting around a cozy table. So let's just kind of pretend that that's the way it is. Even though I'm standing up here, we'll just kind of pretend I'm sitting across the table from you. At least we got comfy chairs and mood lighting here, so we're halfway there. So what I wanted to do is just quickly talk about the Office of EdTech. I'm the Deputy Director of that office at the U.S. Department of Education. And it's some of you may or may not be aware of what we do. So give me the 30-second sponsored by slide here. The Office of EdTech is where we set the vision and strategy for technology integration across the country. So we have a document that I'll show you in a second called the National EdTech Plan. But one of the important things is a lot of times people think about the department and think that we have a focus on sort of K-12 or a particular area. And while we certainly care about K-12, our office cuts across all different pieces of the department and the work. So we care a lot about what's happening in the K-12 space, also post-secondary space, adult education, so beyond when they're out in the workforce, you know, how is technology being used to learn? We heard some great comments from Elliot Macy earlier today about the importance of learning in the workplace, and that's 60%, I think was the stat, of post-secondary learning is not in higher education institutions, and also, of course, special education. So those are some of the areas that we look at, and we cut across all of these and try to make that very clear in the approach that we take. So I mentioned the National EdTech Plan. If you are not familiar with this, it's worth just taking a minute to look at. It basically steps through how technology can play an important role in teaching, learning, and assessment, and then how infrastructure supports all three of those. And so it's a great document to become familiar with. It's available at ed.gov/technology. There's also a nice executive summary if you don't have time to read the whole thing but want to just get a quick view of what's going on. It's available there in English and Spanish if we have any colleagues from other parts of the world. One of the things that is an important goal that our president has set out for us is how do we deal with college affordability and access. So a number of the things that we're looking at is also what do we do to make this make it easier for people to have access to school, to colleges, and also to make that that affordable. A couple interesting statistics that should certainly wake us up if we are not already aware of the severity of the issue. By 2025, 263 million students will be ready to go to college. So if we were to try to meet that demand, we would have to open 4 universities capable of serving 30,000 students per week for the next 15 years. Right? So I'm not sure about what you guys think, but it seems to me like that's probably not going to be very feasible. I don't know how we've done this week, but it seems like we're probably not going to make it if we continue that same approach of building buildings and having people come and sit in buildings and be talked to. So we really need to think about how technology can be leveraged to change the approach, right? So not just speed up what we already have. That's not going to get us here. It's going to be how do we completely reimagine learning. And then the other thing, of course, is affordability. And, you know, we like STEM, so I'll put this as an equation here. More and more, no matter what level of math students are taking in school, they are becoming very familiar with this equation here, which is this piece of paper worth the amount of money that I have to pay per year to get it? Right? And that's a legitimate question. It's a legitimate question that students should, and they should be asking that, and we should be asking that too. Is this piece of paper that we're giving worth that amount of money? And that's not the purpose of this discussion, and I'm not going to sort of dive into that. But this point is, we need to be asking: what's the return on investment? Is it worthwhile when there are other options, right? Online and free open courses, and so I think what it starts to do is say, well, what's the role of universities and colleges, and how do we shift in a world that's very different than it used to be to still providing value? And by the way, I do think there's great value in traditional universities using new models and approaches, and I'll share a couple examples. The nice part here is there are some important trends that we see that are helping to help us figure out how to deal with these tricky issues. Personalizing learning. There's been a lot of talk about that. There's a lot of opportunity to say how, you know, one way to lower cost is just to make sure that a student is receiving what they need when they need it and not sitting in a class wasting time because they have gotten that skill somewhere else, right? We treat everybody essentially the same when they come into our classes, and I felt for a long time that the least equitable thing we can do is treat all students the same, because they come in with different backgrounds and experiences, and they need to be treated and receive the information, the learning experiences that they need. Competency-based learning ties into that. We've heard about that. Digital content, how to take advantage of all this wonderful digital content that's available, the whole MOOC movement, right? Whether who knows what that's going to turn into and what that will look like, but understanding that and playing in that space is really important. And learning analytics and big data. You know, what do we do when we have digital, you know, students on digital devices and we can collect literally hundreds of thousands of data points off of what they do? How does that change decisions that we're making about learning and what they should be experiencing? One more quick point on that, and that is we recently posted this report on learning analytics. Again, same site, ed.gov/technology. And so if you're new to this idea of learning analytics or big data for learning, or have colleagues that may be less familiar with it, this is a great report, and it's, you know, we try as much as we can. I know people think government reports and everybody kind of starts to slip into a coma. We try very hard to make this readable and accessible, and there are recommendations at the end for higher ed, for government, for industry, and so encourage you to take a look at that and share that with others. What I want to do today, though, is talk about accelerating innovation through two specific projects. We'll just pick two. There's a number that we have going on, but these are two that I am involved with, and I'd love to just tell you about them and get your feedback as well. The first is called Education Innovation Clusters, and the second is called the Education Data Initiative, but commonly known as Data Palooza. So we'll talk about both of those. Really quickly, though, before jumping in, let me just take a second and offer a definition of innovation. You know, we can talk about accelerating innovation and why we could accelerate innovation, but if we're not clear on what the heck we mean by innovation, then the rest of the conversation kind of doesn't have much value. So let me offer this as a suggestion. Innovation is something that significantly improves on the status quo, shatters the status quo, and can scale. And what we see a lot of times, by the way, are what I would call an invention, which is something that has great impact. I see that a lot when I visit schools of education, and they say, well, we figured out exactly how to teach math. We can get every one of these students learning math perfectly. Great. How many students is it affecting? Well, the six kids that are in my pilot group, right, that I've written the paper about. And so that's phenomenal, and it's great that you can do that, but it doesn't really make significant difference if it can't scale to reach more people. Right, so on the flip side, we have a similar issue where, and this usually tends to come from folks, you know, building apps and tools, where they can take something and through their great skill of developing and scaling, can move it out to wide groups and wide audiences, but it's not necessarily based on something that's sound pedagogically, right? Something that actually is making significant improvements in the learning. And so those are kind of what fall on either side there. And what we want to do is get it up in the middle there. So we have something that is, you know, as it says here, a product or strategy that greatly improves on the status quo and can scale. And that's when we get innovation. So that's what we'll talk about today. And I would suggest that it cannot happen if we work in silos. So if just a university, a research institution says, we're going to tackle this issue, but not involve entrepreneurs and developers who really know how to handle scale, it's probably not going to happen. Likewise, if developers, you know, if you walk up to the sales floor up there, and people say, well, we're going to totally do this. We can get every kid in the country, every student in the world with one of these things in their hands. Well, that's great, but it's probably going to then fall back into the trend side. So keeping it up in the middle is important. So that's what we hope these initiatives try to do. Innovation clusters. This is an idea that came from originally this guy, Michael Porter, from Harvard, and he said in a world where we are interconnected and highly digital and have overnight shipping and global markets and all that sort of stuff, regional location shouldn't matter for economic advantage, as he was looking at it from that standpoint. And in fact, what he found out as he looked across regions in the country is it did. And that regions that had a concentrated group around a particular area, right, were economically more viable. They had competitive advantage, is the word he uses, than other regions. And so it's an interesting concept. And so we said, well, what would that look like in education? So here's my attempt at showing what an education innovation cluster might look like. And it's these three partners: having research partners, having commercial partners, and having education partners, and the things that they bring to the table. And so you see that in order to kind of make this, to have this regional hub, right, we need to say in a particular area, this is what we care about. We care about, personalizing learning or data analytics or just lowering dropout rate. Pick whatever it is. But this is something that we're going to care about. And it's not just going to be the research institution that's going to take it on, but it's going to be the research institution paired with local developers and entrepreneurs, paired with education partners who often just are totally left out of the loop, whether it's in the K-12 space or people delivering courses in community college or even at the same universities where we're doing the research, right? And so this is the idea of what an innovation cluster might look like. Now, unfortunately, and this is an eye chart, and don't even try to get into this. In fact, it'll probably damage you even more if you do. The point that I'm trying to show here is we have a research and development cycle in education that is not working effectively. And so we have up here in this left corner in blue, basic applied sort of research, and then this shows sort of how it connects into commercialization in the market and then how that loops into integrating with schools or with learning environments and how that data would feed back into more, you've seen charts like this from other industries. The problem is in education that doesn't happen. So when we finish the research and development and say here's this great thing, we know a better way to teach science, right? What we end up doing is saying, I will now publish this in a journal and I am done. Right? And so what you see here is that does not inform the next step, which is the development of the products. Now meanwhile, there's off somewhere in other places somebody building all these great products. But they're also doing the same thing on the next part, so then they aren't involved when it goes into schools. I talk to vendors a lot, and I love this. I say, you really aren't involving teachers in the development of your products. They say, sure we are. Look, when we finish the whole thing, we go and say, do you like the blue button or the red button better? We take their feedback into mind, right? Now, that's obviously not what I'm talking about. We need to make sure that the teachers and whoever's delivering content and learning experiences are involved in the design, right? Not just where the button is or what color it is, but what's the approach? Right? And I think that's one of the reasons that we end up replicating sort of in a digital version a lot of traditional teaching models. That's what the LMS does, quite frankly, is it sort of replicates the classroom. We're not going to reach these goals that we need to if we're just replicating in a digital format traditional learning. Same, by the way, with a lot of digital textbooks, by the way. So we need to really think beyond that. Okay, so another eye chart here, but this is just to show there are some elements that we identified that we thought would be necessary to be an innovation cluster. So things like having research centers, having supports for entrepreneurs, having design centers, having some sort of financial support, common metrics across the different partners, ways to share knowledge and information. And by the way, at the end, I will point you to a place where you can see all of this stuff. So don't worry about if you can't quite snap a picture or anything. I'll get you access to everything that I'm going to show here. The cool part is when we went out and looked around, we saw there are actually places that are starting to do this. So we identified a number of forward-leaning regions here. So Boston, New York, we have North Carolina Research Triangle area, Phoenix, Arizona area with SkySong. There are a number of cool places that are starting to do this. And what we said was we need to figure out how we can support this. And so we brought a whole bunch of people together at UPenn. They were gracious enough to host us. We came together and said, what do we do to solidify this? And what our role is, we're trying to say, how can we make it easier for people at a regional level to think, first of all, just to think about what does it mean to be an innovation cluster, to pull that together, and then to be able to leverage those economic advantages of working together in order to accelerate innovation. So I'm going to do something a little bit different than probably other sessions. I'm going to stop at a couple times through and take questions along the way. So in a minute, I'm going to talk about Data Palooza stuff. But if I go on there, you'll have forgotten all about innovation clusters by the time I get to that. So what I'd love to do is just pause for a minute and take any questions or hear any feedback you have about this idea of innovation clusters and how we can take it a step forward, or also how just to clarify anything you have. So one thing that I have been asked to do, though, is remind everybody that we do have people online. And so if you ask something from your seat, they won't be able to hear you. And we are all about new models of learning, and so it would be kind of awkward if we came here to this conference to talk about the power of online learning and then left those online learners off the experience. So please use these two microphones here. So let me do that then. Let me pause and just say, any questions, comments, or thoughts about this idea of innovation clusters? Just come up to the microphone there. Oh, yeah.
I'm curious what role in the vendor space or what role in the educational space you see for-profit institutions playing in an innovation cluster.
Yeah, great question. So I think whether it's for-profit or not, I don't think matters as much as the expertise they bring to the table. So if it's a for-profit institution, for example, that has a really strong research base, right, bench strength there, they could be hugely, hugely powerful stepping up in providing the, you know, the, being that partner that talks about, you know, what are we seeing that's actually effective, doing the evaluation on this sort of stuff, right? On the flip side, there may be a for-profit institution that really focuses on delivering high-quality learning experiences. And so in that case, they may have the hat of the sort of the educator role, which is as you're building in these things, we're going to stay involved as a test bed or a test kitchen. I heard somebody use that term, right? To actually be able to try this stuff out and rapidly iterate. I hate ribbon cuttings when it comes to software, right, or programs. I hate, like, we are done, cut the ribbon, here we go, right? I would rather have it always be, everything I've ever done is in beta forever. I've never had anything that's not in pilot or beta mode because it should always be evolving and changing. And so that's another role that both for-profits and non-profit institutions can play in being the delivery partner and testing and sort of collecting that out. So, yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned the different characteristics of the clusters, but do you see some common themes for their creation? You mentioned the ones that exist, or some things that we, takeaways that we could use in terms of trying to establish them.
Yeah, so great question about, what are some common themes? One of the things that I found as we've looked across the country and seen these and seen how they're working is this ability to come together. And this is going to sound, I'm hearing myself say it, and I'm thinking, wow, you're going to be expecting some great grand, you know, formula that I can tell you that will make this happen. It actually comes down to just coming together and having a conversations, right? Having interactions. So most of the time, and you could do this, we just do this question in your mind here, think about the regions that you're in, the areas that you're in. How often are you, if you're in an education institution, how often are you interacting with your local developers and entrepreneurs? Do you know them? Do you know the best coders and the best developer shops in your town? Likewise, how often are you connected with people that are delivering learning experiences other than maybe your own institutions, right? And so I think that's where it starts. It starts by somebody coming together and saying, how do we get together and how do we figure out how to share these best practices in a way that we all do better? It's an all ships rise sort of thing, right? Especially as a region starts to begin to see the value of external partners. And we've seen this in a number of places where funders say, hey, and sorry for the cliche, but, you know, the Silicon Valley of personalized learning is wherever, right? That's where they're going to want to go and say, how can we invest? How can we make sure we're a part of this? By the way, I should mention one other thing, and that is we have a program called DC to VC, where we go across the country and meet with venture capitalists, and we say, if you're going to go fund stuff in education, how can we help make sure you're funding stuff that's meaningful? One of the things that we talk to them about is this concept of innovation clusters. And if you're going to be funding somewhere, fund places where we have these great partnerships coming together. Yes, sir.
So the practical question from what you just said then is, if I am at an institution in one of those regions and I want to go back,
yeah,
is there something practical I can tell my superiors, here's how to get involved?
Yeah, a great question. How do you get this started? So I think the first thing that you do, and this is what we've seen, and by the way, all of this stuff, this is new. We're figuring this out, right? So you may come back to me and say, you know, I went back and that didn't work, but here's what did, and I actually would encourage you to do that. But to go back and say, here's this concept, this innovation cluster idea. There are places across the country that are starting to do that. I think it would be valuable for us to start to participate. What do we do? In most cases, you then say, let's pull some people together. Now, here's the way some people did it. I just got back from Stanford University, which is one of the areas that's kind of where there's an innovation cluster forming around. And we kicked off. We had a meetup. We opened it up sort of publicly. We posted on meetup.com and said, everybody come here, and this is what we're going to talk about. And we made sure, you had to make sure we had the right people there. So we made sure we had students there. We made sure we had developers there from the community. We made sure we had researchers there from Stanford, right? We made sure we brought some venture capitalists there, came together and said, here's the idea. How do we kick this off the ground and what do we do? And so that would be one simple way to start, is say, just have the conversation, but make sure you're stacking the cards as to who's there. That's the biggest problem, is oftentimes we just talk to ourselves, right? So we say, let's be innovative, and we get a bunch of faculty together and talk about innovation, right? But we're not going to get that scale part if we don't have developers sitting there. And there's fascinating conversations. I've had sometimes where some, you know, developer, some, you know, like, 18-year-old kid who's built some crazy bunch of iPhone apps, doing really great stuff, sitting there talking to faculty members and going, do you know that's like the most ineffective possible way to collect that data? Like, you're talking about walking around and writing on a piece of, on a clipboard? What about this? And they just come up with some phenomenal ideas, right? So it's a really neat experience to do when you bring those folks together. So I think that's the way to start. Yeah, one more question, and then I'll move on and talk about some other things. Yeah?
Hey, do you find that these are usually more formal partnerships, or are they sometimes more formal partnerships, or more of a ad hoc basis? And if they are on a volunteer sort of ad hoc basis, is anyone's voice lost in that process that is a significant stakeholder?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think one of the challenges is there's a lot of cross-silo, cross-disciplinary conversations happening, but they're not formal enough. Now, you don't want to over-formalize things, right? You don't want to make it, you want lots of creative space, and people don't work for the same, you know, there are different companies and different organizations that are participating. But at the same time, there's been a lot of places where I said, you know, I was talking to somebody, this is actually from Nashville, they have a budding innovation cluster there. I said, you know, we kind of get together once a week and talk about these issues. So, well, guess what? You're on the way to having an innovation cluster. They bring in people from around the region. But if I went up to any of you individually and said, are you part of a thing, right? Are you part of a cluster? Are you part of something bigger than just you sitting at a table? They'd all say no, right? And so then you don't get the advantage of people thinking of you as the center where this great stuff is happening. And so part of it is saying, we are a thing, right? We're bringing these people together, and we are an innovation cluster, and we focus on this, and have enough structure around it that there is some identity. So having identity is important. And then beyond that, the level of structure, I think, depends on what it is that is trying to be tackled. Let me mention sort of one final invite, and then we'll move on to talk about something else, which is there is another event coming up, an Innovation Cluster webinar on the 7th. And what we've done is we've gone to what I think is one of the most effective innovation clusters in the country, not for education, by the way. It's for biotech. In BioSt. Louis, they had a whole bunch of different partners. They had kind of in that area, they had some research partners, they had some companies that were building stuff, but they're all working by themselves. And they said, this is crazy. We're going to pull this together, and we're going to create BioSt. Louis. And it's going to be an innovation cluster around bioscience. And they've done a great job. They've done the stats are incredible, the amount of additional funding that they've brought in because of this, and really some neat accelerations of innovation that you see. So we've invited the leaders of BioSt. Louis to come and talk to us, knowing that we're interested in forming innovation clusters. And as we try to do with everything, it's open. So feel free to come and join that. And again, if you don't catch the QR code there, if you go to ed.gov/technology and click on projects, there's a RSVP, and you can come and join the conversation. And certainly encourage others to do that as well. And we'll talk about some of those issues. So the questions about how do we get this formed, instead of asking me, right, let's ask somebody who's actually done it, actually started and formed a good innovation cluster, and see their ideas. So let me leave that invitation with you. Now, let me move on to the second part here, which is Data Palooza. And data is an interesting thing. When we think about accelerating innovation, one of the things that we realize is that a lot of innovation happens when data is available. So data, in some ways, is like the rocket fuel for innovation. And we've seen that in other places, too. If you think about the, let's take the weather, for example. Think about GPS. This is an even better example. I'll give a NOAA example. So global positioning system, that's data, essentially, government infrastructure, sort of data that became available that was opened up to the public to create innovative tools with it. That has led, by the way, to a $90 billion industry, right, around using that data. So tons and tons. Think right now. Whoever has one of these in their pockets is leveraging that data that's available. So data spurs innovation. Now, we want to see the same thing happening in education. We believe that if we open data in education, we will be able to spur new types of innovation. So here's what we did. We said, look, we're going to pull together new types of data. And we said, we'll open data, make data about content available. I'll talk to you about these projects in a second. We'll make data about performance trends available, and we'll make data about competencies and data about individual performance available. So those are the types of data that we said we would make available. And I'll talk to you quickly about each of these projects. I won't take much time, but I'm happy to go in more detail if anybody's interested. The first is the learning registry. So learning, we have an interesting problem in this country, and that is there's lots and lots of open resources, free educational resources, but they're scattered all over the place, and they're really hard to find. And it's really hard to find information about those that content, right? So what standards do they align to? Do people think they're effective? That sort of thing. The only way to do it is just to search all over the place, and that's not very easy to do and not very convenient. So the Learning Registry is an open infrastructure that we've created, and we said anybody who has a content repository, take the data about your content and put it in the Learning Registry. And then developers and, you know, so teachers and parents and students and whatever can come in and start to build apps on top of the Learning Registry and have access to all of the content from, eventually we hope to have all of the learning content in the world registered in the Learning Registry. And it's open, so we don't have to do it. It's not something that's crowdsourced, and so anybody who has a content repository simply plugs in and says, here's all the content that we have. Now, this is not a portal. You can't log, you can't go to Learning Registry and start browsing content. That's not what we're trying to do. That's not the role of the federal government. What we're trying to do is say, here's a database that holds information. It says where all this stuff is and the metadata about it, so that then if you have, let's say in your institution, you have, you know, greatteachingresources.whatever.edu, right? You can plug into the Learning Registry and start surfacing all these phenomenal learning resources without having to go one-off to Khan Academy and to PBS and to any other place and try to get those connections being made. So a very powerful approach. So that's the first thing there. Again, happy to talk more about it later. The second is education.data.gov is a site we've stood up because there's tons of open data sets that say everything from performance of schools to how much federal aid money an institution gets that are really useful for people to leverage to build tools that can help students make better decisions. And so those are available on that site for people to use. Another example is Open Badges. Anybody here working with doing stuff with Open Badges, the Open Badges Project? Okay, only familiar with the Open Badges Project. Let's try that. Okay, a little bit better. So Open Badges, I guess, is this idea. I mean, the best way to talk about it is sort of micro-credentials. So you can say, as you demonstrate competency, we can give you a credential in this particular area, right? We can give you this badge that shows that you have done it. One of the challenges here is that, you know, I think when I was in school and I went through a bunch of courses and after I got out, I applied for jobs and sort of other things, and nobody ever asked me what courses I took. It's kind of hard for me because I spent a lot of money on them and I was all proud of my transcript and nobody ever asked. Don't you feel badly for me? Nobody cared what courses I took, right? But here's what they did care about. They wanted to know what I'd done. Right, so as I went through this master's program, like what projects did I work on? What competencies did I have out of that expensive education that I just paid for? I didn't have a good way to show them that. Now I try to explain it and tell stories and do little works of theater and draw pictures and stuff and try to get that across, but it's not easy to do. And so what Open Badges does is it says as you're going along and can demonstrate competencies inside or outside of formal education, you can receive a badge, a digital badge, that I can then keep as part of a portfolio that I can show essentially what my capabilities are. So very, very powerful, and that's another tool that people are using to be able to build apps. Okay, one final one, and then I'll talk a little bit more about what the Data Palooza event was. This is called My Data. So one of the challenges, we hear everybody talk about, well, I wish we had the Amazon.com of learning, or I wish we had the Netflix of learning, right? You hear that sort of stuff, and what they mean by that is wish we had it personalized. Well, the reason that Netflix and Amazon can personalize learning is because they have data about you, right? You can't personalize if we don't have some data about you as a learner. And so one of the challenges here is that we're asking developers and folks to make great products with data, and it wasn't available. And so we started this initiative called the My Data Initiative, or the My Data Button, which basically said, went out to schools and universities and states and vendors and said, if you have a student information system, you need to put a button on it that allows your students to download their data and take it with them. They should be able to export their data off of your system and take it. It's their data, right? I know we sometimes forget that. We think we're kind of like, we own the data. It's not. It's the student's data. We're just the stewards. We hold it in our system, but it's their data. And we need to make sure that they can take it with them. Right now, in most cases, the best they can do is kind of hit print, right? On the, you know, they can log into their grade system and hit print and take a bunch of paper with them, which is kind of not very helpful, especially in a digital world. So by going out and saying, put a My Data button on, download your data, and then there are other tools and developers that can say, give us that data, whatever you choose to of it, and we will help you make better decisions with it. A couple quick examples. As we've been going out and asking vendors to participate, we need to make sure that we're eating our own dog food. So at the department, we have two systems. Most of our data at the department, by the way, is not personal level data. Some people forget that. They're like, well, you have all this data. Why don't you just make it available? Well, no, we actually don't. We have very little data about individual students. It's almost all aggregate data sets, which are available up on data.gov, so you can go look at it. But one of the areas where we do have personalized data, individual student data, is when it comes to financial aid. So our NSLDS and our FAFSA tools are both places where we know individual, we have individual student information. And so we've put already in place today on the NSLDS system is a My Data button. So students can go in and download their information from NSLDS or student loan system and take it with them and use it for other tools or to create their own personal profile, right, where they can keep their own data. And coming in just a few months, there will be one on the FAFSA tool as well. So when you fill out the FAFSA, you can take all that data and you could use it for student loan calculators or other things. Instead of right now, what students do is they enter it in FAFSA and they go and enter it in another school to get an idea of a tuition calculator, and they will go enter it somewhere else and they enter the same data a bazillion times. It's crazy. So enter it once and then be able to use it. And then, of course, we have a bunch of vendor partners, as I mentioned, that's participating. Pearson, for example, has put My Data Button in PowerSchool Initiative, which is their K-12 tool rolled out across the country, right? There's others that are coming online as well. So there's some really cool partnerships that are happening, and we know that we can't do this from the federal government level. This has to be a bunch of people stepping up and saying, we will put a My Data Button on our tool, on our system. So finally, Datapalooza. We know that as much as I love data, and as great as open data is, I can't pour data on a student and make them smarter, much as I would like to do that and maybe have tried a couple times. I can't dump data on the front of a school and fix it, right? And so one of the things that we need to do is say, all this data is available, but it's only useful when we build stuff that helps students make better choices. So we said, well, what if we do this? We're going to bring a whole bunch. We went out and found as many developers as we could find, you know, the people who are building tools in the ed tech space and doing good stuff, and even some that weren't in the ed tech space but were building good tools with data, brought them together and said, hey, here's what we want you to do. We want you to build really awesome tools using this open data, these types of open data that we mentioned before, and then show them off to us. They said, you know, this is an interesting thing because it's not a grant. We don't have any money for it, but here's what we'll do. In 90 days, we'll come back, and we'll host an event at the White House, and we'll just tell everybody how awesome you are. How about that? So I did this, and I thought, I wonder if anybody's actually going to be crazy enough to do this, right? I thought maybe we'd have, you know, five people that would come in the door and do it. We ended up having 25 different projects. And by the way, our rule was it had to work. We couldn't, vaporware didn't count. It wasn't like one of those, you know, here's what it would look like in Photoshop when I get some funding. You know, it had to actually work, like code that actually worked. That was the deal. We had 25 vendors come across the line and actually have products that they were able to, some big guys, some little ones, some startups, whole bunch of players, and came up with some really, really awesome tools. And that's what we did just a little while ago at Datapalooza. These tools are available for students. A couple examples, there's a great one. They're probably going to have to change this name because they'll probably get sued if they go with it, but Kayak for Colleges, which helps using that expected family contribution, which we will make available from the Department of Ed as a My Data button, can be plugged in and say, what does college actually cost for me? Remember, because that's challenging for students. They go and look on the website, and it says here's how much it costs, but you know that is not really the same when you factor in what scholarships they could get or what. Anyway. So it says here's what you would actually pay based on your information, where you live, and tuition rates, and make some better decisions. Students like me says, what are students similar to you with similar learning profiles and styles and that sort of stuff? And by the way, when I say styles, I don't mean like the learning, like I'm an audio learner or whatever that is, because I don't buy that. But you know, similar habits, similar preferences, right? What are they choosing? And help that make, look, other than maybe buying a house, paying for education is the most expensive thing that most people are going to pay for in their life. And yet today, the way they make that decision pretty much is, wow, that's a nice picture of the football team there, right? Truly, that's how we make the, and we need to make sure, part of lowering college costs is making sure that those decisions are made, data-based decisions. And so that's what we hope some of these tools will do. One other, there's this, an example, Learning Gems was just one of the other projects that came through, which is kind of a neat thing where they would just pull in all your data and package it into these little gems that you could then choose if somebody was saying, hey, here's my, you know, you need this information in order to apply for a scholarship or whatever. You could say, here's the three gems you need. You select them on your web browser, and it would automatically go and fill in their website. It's pretty cool. So just some examples. There's a whole bunch more that I don't have time to show you today, but you have time to look at it as you fly home or wherever you go. And so I will point you to our website here. And actually, it looks like I have half a minute, so why don't I do this? Let me just pick one or two. We won't play the whole thing, because they're 7 minutes each, but let me just play 1 minute of a couple of them, just so you get a flavor of what happened. Let's do, here, let me see if I can get a web browser up. There we go. Hey, all right. So let's go in here, and you'll see this is our channel, and then if you go down, you'll see all of the Datapalooza videos right there in this playlist. And, oh, let's, you don't want to hear me, you probably don't want to hear me now, and you're stuck with me, so let's pick somebody else. Let's try that one right there. I'll just do the first minute, and then I'll cut it off, but it'll give you a flavor.
So the human race is about to enter a totally data-mined existence, And it's going to be really fun to watch. It's going to be one of those things where our grandkids are going to tell our kids, I can't believe you grew up in a world like that, just the way our kids complain that we went to record stores. You know, when Tom Cruise walks through the mall in Minority Report and the ad beams right to his eyes and says, hey, Mr. Cruise, you should go on that Caribbean vacation you've been thinking about. I know some entrepreneurs who are working on that technology right now. And, you know, I'm still waiting for the day when my refrigerator is going to know when I'm running out of milk and just order it for me automatically on Fresh Direct. I think that day is coming in a few years. It's not far off. The world in 30 years is going to be unrecognizably data mined. So what does that mean for education? Well, education happens to be today the world's most data mineable industry by far, and it's not even close. Right? So maybe one day healthcare will be up there when they have little nanobots that are in your bloodstream that are doing real-time analysis. But until then, it's not close. Education beats everything else hands down. So let's
Okay. Cut off after a minute. This is just a teaser. So that's one example. Let me give. I'm just going to check. Maybe we have time for one or maybe two more, just to give you a sense of the type of things that projects that were there. Let's look at. Oh, let's try this one. This is a kind of interesting one.
Great. So I'm Adam Wenschel. I'm with EverFi. At EverFi, we teach students critical life skills such as financial literacy, substance abuse, digital citizenship, civic engagement. Universal authentication is the idea that teachers and students should be able to access all their technology resources with one username and one password. It's an important subject to us at EverFi, and here's the reason. 1408, 14 minutes and 8 seconds. That's the amount of time from when the first student rolls into a classroom, accesses our platform, to the time his last classmate has finished the registration process and is engaged in learning. And we have very good usability. So this says, you know, in a 50-minute class period, a third of it is being lost to account creation. So we started talking to our friends Mozilla, you know, about putting together a project on universal authentication. And Mozilla, everyone knows them for the Firefox browser. They've actually done a lot of great work on a range of subjects, promoting openness and interoperability in a healthy digital ecosystem. And one of their projects is called Persona. It's a way to...
Okay, I told you 1 minute. I'm going to cut it off. It's just a teaser. Let me do one more and give you a sense of what they're talking about. Last one. Gosh, there's a whole bunch. Hard to pick. Let's try this one right here. Again, I'll just play the first minute to give you a sense, and then we'll move on.
Hi, I'm Shane Green. I'm co-founder and CEO of Personal, and Ginny's in the back. We're going to show a video and a couple of other presos, and she's accompanied by Josh Galper and Ashley Peterson from our team. But why don't we start with the video we wanted to show you guys.
My name is Alfredo. I'm from Ethiopia. I came to the U.S. in 2005. My mom speaks a little bit English, and she has no idea about how to use a computer. We didn't have the luxury of using computers back home. Applying for college was pretty straightforward. The problem was paying for college, so you had to go through the FAFSA process, which is really challenging, especially for someone that never used a computer and is not good in English. I work 25 to 30 hours a week, plus I do an internship, and I go full-time at university with school and work, finding the time to give the same information over and over again for the same reason. It gets hard. I almost gave up. It was too stressful, and like I was always worried about, am I going to pay for college? Are they going to drop my classes?
Every year, students spend millions of hours filling out their FAFSA and then retyping the same information on scholarship applications and other forms. Students like Alfredo can access a copy of their records through the Department of Education's My Data Initiative. Personal secure data platform will then allow students to organize, store, and reuse that information on scholarship.
Okay, told you to cut it off. That's just one other example here. And so what I would encourage you to do is take a look at some of these great data projects that have come out of that and see which ones make sense to take advantage of for your institutions. So before we open it up for additional questions, let me just suggest what's next here. The first is you need to enable My Data. This isn't a form. It's not a format. It's not a structure. It's just making sure that you and your systems and your institutions, or if there are software developers here and the tools that you're building, that students have the ability to download their data in a common machine-readable format. Right? You take your pick. We want to open machine-readable, but they need to be able to export it. By the way, if any of you have used like Google Takeout, for example, where there's an opportunity where Google's implemented this, you can go any of Google's tools, you can go in and export all the data they have about you. If you want to leave Google, you can take it all with you. Right? That's essentially what this is. This is Google Takeout for Education. So you need to make sure that it's enabled. Your vendors know about it. I guarantee you, your vendors know about it. So if you call them, and it's very easy for them to implement, a quick call and say, hey, make sure there's a My Data button in place, they will make sure that happened. The second is, we need to make sure we're showing students how to use their data. Show them what tools to use to help them make these better decisions. Help them become good data stewards and understand how they can save time and money by using data. And then for developers that we have here, and also folks at universities that are building their own tools, make sure you're leveraging learning tools and creating tools to help personalize the learning. Right? Build tools that take advantage of the data that students have in order to improve their learning experience and make better choices. So those are the next steps that I would encourage you to take. So we have about 5 minutes here left, so let me do this and go back and open up for questions, comments, and have a bit of a discussion before we all run off to the next thing. Thoughts, questions, comments? Maybe none. You don't have to have any. I just thought I'd, you know, give you the opportunity here. So let me ask this question. How many of you have implemented a My Data button at your institution? Yikes. Okay. So note to self, right? Take out right here, simple note or whatever you use, right? Right on the top there, it is call your vendor and make sure the student, it is really, really important to make sure that students have access to this data. It's if they don't have it, you know, that it all sort of stops, and that's something that we can't do. That's something you have to do. You have to make sure that they're having access to their own data. Let me mention one other thing then that we'll use to wrap up here, and that is that if you're interested in learning more about this, there is an article in EDUCAUSE Review in this particular edition that we all got called something similar to this presentation. I think it's Innovation Clusters and Data Palooza or something like that. And in there, talks about both initiatives and specifically talks in more detail about the types of data and gives links to where those data are available and how you can leverage those to help students make better decisions. And so take a look at that. Share that with the folks in your institution so that they can start to do better things. And also, as you start to form innovation clusters, a lot of people doing hackathons and sort of events to try to build these tools that we need for the future. Make sure they're leveraging this open data. It's extremely, extremely powerful. I've been to so many of these sort of edu hackathons, and I get sort of tired of it. It's to the point where I can almost walk in and say, I know what five apps are going to come out at the end of this thing, right? It's going to be an SMS app for teachers. It's going to be some gradebook thing. Those aren't helpful for helping us reach this challenge of providing access to these 263 million students that will need college in the next 20 years, right? We need better tools. And so leveraging open data and helping really take advantage of those development cycles are really important. So with that, thanks. Happy to keep in touch. You're welcome to follow us here and give me feedback that way as well. And happy to stick around for a few minutes if anybody else has any other comments. Thanks so much.